You're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And we're here once again to answer your questions about animal behavior. So if you need help understanding why animals do some of the really incredible things they do, give us a call now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And in addition to the calls, of course, we have another special topic to share. And what's our topic today, Patricia?
Today we're going to look at dog names, why we choose the names we do, how those names affect our relationship with our dogs, and, of course, how they can affect behavior.
They can really affect behavior.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I'm all ears for that one. A little bit later on in the show, an interview that will make Winnie the Pooh swoon with delight, Patricia. We'll talk with author Holly Bishop about her book, Robbing the Bees, A Biography of Honey. But first, let's take some calls. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Mike. I'm calling from Dubuque.
Mike, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
I'm a psychologist, and I work at a college campus. And we had a dog for a long time. Speaking of names, his name was Sigmund.
Most appropriate.
He passed on to that great land in the sky where there's always somebody to pet him.
Yeah.
And we're ready to get a new dog, and I'm thinking of getting a dog that we can use as that I could use as a therapy dog at the college. So I wanted to get some ideas about what to look for. Should I get a puppy? Should I get an older dog?
Sure.
And finally, where does one get training? I've looked around here, and I haven't found anything. But maybe there are some ideas that you could give me about how to go about finding training.
Sure, yeah. That's a bunch of excellent questions. The first one about how do you select a dog, and several questions within that. One is puppy or older dog.
Right.
There are pluses and minuses, obviously, of both. With the puppy, you have the advantage of being able to start from the very beginning. You can start great shaping and conditioning and wonderful positive training. You can also expose the puppy during these critical and sensitive periods of socialization, so it's used to lots and lots of things. The downside with getting a puppy, if you have a specific goal in mind, a kind of a sort of a working goal, is that, you know, you don't know how that dog's going to turn out. You just don't. It's
don't.
No matter how much you do, there's still that genetics. And as all parents know, their children, and this is the same as puppies, are not clones of the parents. So you can invest a huge amount of time and energy and end up having a dog who's snappy in strange situations, for example.
Yeah.
So that's the puppy. The older dog side is you don't get the chance to do all that conditioning and shaping, but you're more likely to know what you're getting. Then it's going to take you 3 months, not 3 days, but 3 months to know what you're getting rather than maybe 2 years. So most importantly, what I would look for in a therapy dog is a dog who is mellow, who is not the kind of dog who is reacting to everything. There's a noise, the dog jumps up. The dog is touched and he looks sort of alarmed. What you want for a therapy dog is you want a quiet, mellow, sort of squinty-eyed, friendly dog who's very happy to see you, but not the kind of dog who's so happy to see you that they knock you over and bowl you over. You know, and I should say limited experience with people who work with therapy dogs is that they want a dog who's there when the client needs it and who is not there when the client doesn't. So I would look for mellow. You know, don't be getting hyperactive. Don't get a feel-bred black Labrador, you know, who's just dying to work 10 hours a day or something like that. So that's probably the most important part. In terms of training, I know there are some organizations. I can't give you the exact titles just off the top of my head. I think there's an International Therapy Dog Association. If you Google therapy dogs, I know you'll find some associations.
Okay.
And because you can get dogs certified under some of these umbrellas.
Okay.
But in terms of training, basically what you want is a dog who will do the basics no matter how distracted they are. So you need to use lots of positive reinforcement to teach the dog it's in his or her best interest to lie down and stay when asked, to come when called, to basically listen, not jump up, etc.
Yep.
Good luck.
I'm with you. I think I'd be inclined to go with an animal that's maybe a little older rather than start from scratch.
there, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages either way. Partly you just have to decide, do I want to raise a puppy for 3 years?
Well, that's what I was thinking. I'm not sure
Larry's
I wanted to
do
that.
Larry's got a little girl. He's got a little toddler at home, so he's...
I know about raising little kids, and it's a lot of work.
Little sleep-deprived, are you, Larry?
It's a lot of fun, but it's a lot of work. You know, we received an email from a listener named Savannah, and she's having a problem with her pet rabbit. She's named Cuddles.
Cuddles?
Yeah. When she lets Cuddles out of his cage, Cuddles will occasionally unravel a section of their carpet. He does this by pulling on a string of the mesh carpet backing near a corner or a wall. And she says she's trimmed away the stray carpet strings, and she thinks that he must pull them out from the edge of the carpet. How can she let him out of his cage without having to watch him like a hawk?
It sounds like he's having such a good time.
Yeah.
It's my favorite game, is go to the carpet and start unraveling it. What fun. Well, there are a couple things I do, and one is just logistical, and I'm sure she's thought of this, but it bears mentioning, which is to just restrict the rabbit such that the rabbit can't get to that area. You know, you might, if it's just the corner, sometimes the nice thing about that kind of carpet problem, which happens with other species also, by the way, ferrets, dogs, cats, birds.
All of them.
Carpets apparently are made... according to
the rest
of the animal world, to be unraveled. I'm sure that's what they think they're for. But you can put a box in the corner. I mean, the good thing about this sort of unraveling is that it usually happens at the edges. So you can cover the edges in some way. You could use child gates, puppy gates, some of those little X-pens, they call them, for puppies and dogs, are really helpful for all kinds of species of animals. You keep animals away. It's not particularly decorative in your living room to have a little wire fence put up.
No.
But, you know, if you can get...
electrified wire fence.
Barbed wire, razor wire, I think that'd be nice. Just make sure the color matches. But there are lots of other things you can do besides this logistical management. And one of them is to teach your rabbit to go immediately to some other fun game. And basically, you're going to have to experiment. You don't have to spend a lot of money necessarily, but you have to be creative. And one thing you might want to consider, now this works with some rabbits, some animals, I should say, and not others, is go buy some cheap carpet samples and have little squares of them and let your rabbit unravel those and just teach your rabbit. You can't go into that corner, but you can play with these. Now, make sure it's safe. Make sure the rabbit's not eating them. Sometimes carpets have materials in them that are toxic. So be careful of that. I don't want your little rabbit eating these things. But if he's just ripping them up and making little piles of synthetic yarn, that should probably be okay. The other thing to think about is what's in the cage. How much does he have to do? You know, probably he's doing this because she's interested or bored. If it's a she, she might be looking for nesting material as well.
Oh.
So think about the whole picture. What does he or she have to do? Provide alternative experiences that don't require you to recarpet your entire home.
Well, thank you for unraveling that mystery.
Oh, you've been waiting for that. Not bad, Mueller. Not bad.
All right. Well, how do people email us questions, by the way?
Oh, we'd love to hear from you. Please send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you have a question, you can join us at 1-800-462-7413. And we have another caller, so let's go there. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name's Christina. I'm calling from Rockford, Illinois.
Christina, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a 4-year-old Cocker Spaniel named Midnight, and ever since she's been a little puppy, she has been scared of her own farts. And it sounds like something made up, but I can explain how it happens.
Dear, and how often does this happen?
Well, maybe like once or twice a day. Not, you know, just typical. I mean, she's not like, you know...
This does not happen every 30 seconds.
Not like some guys I know.
Right? Larry said it. Thanks, Larry.
But what she'll do is, if she's standing up, most of the time she's looking out our sliding glass window, she'll pass gas, you'll hear it, and she'll flip around really quick and stare at her butt.
Oh, honey.
And she'll do the cocking ears and, you know, turn to the side.
What
and if
was
she
that?
Farts again while she's looking at her butt, she'll bark viciously and run
sweetie.
Away from the spot and stare at it.
Oh, sweetie. Well, yeah, here's the first thing to say. This is going to be tough if there's a man in the house, Mueller. for reasons that are completely beyond the knowledge of all women of the world, men think this is the funniest thing that ever happened. And they look at Larry laughing so hard he could barely contain himself.
This is
one of the major sex differences in our species anyway, which is the reaction to this particular biological phenomenon. The director of the UN can be probably, you know, brought down with guffaws by the whole concept. So the reason I bring that up is that if you laugh, you might be encouraging it. You might actually indirectly be reinforcing her. Mm. And as funny as it's hard for me to not laugh now too, as funny as it might be, it's the kind of a fear that could become worse and worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing I would do. And if I were you, as much as you can, the second it happens, I would do everything to distract her. Like find a favorite toy, find something she really loves, and the second you hear it, then redirect your attention to something else. You can have her special passing gas toy. You know, you can give it a particular name if you'd like. But the other thing I think about is that, you know, if she's – Larry's still laughing. I'm not going to be able to stop her. If she's digestively healthy, she really shouldn't be passing gas a couple times a day. So one thing you might want to think about is, if you want to dive into the whole world of
you're not
canine,
eating beans, are you? Yeah.
No, she's eating a weight-controlled food because she was a little hefty as about a two-year-old. So, and our vet has asked us to keep her on only about 2 cups a day of this weight-controlled food.
Yeah, and you know, there are other, and that's obvious, weight control obviously is very important. Larry and I are both on our diets ourselves, as a matter of fact. I would talk to your vet about different brands of kibble light, and also think about adding some fiber. You know, some good natural fibers can be really, really good for dogs. You might want to try a little yogurt and try a little pumpkin, which is good fiber, very good for dogs. So you might try those two things. I actually give my Big Great Pyrenees that every single night. Helps her. So good luck, Larry. Finally stopped laughing, so I think it's time to...
Well,
send you on your way.
And I was thinking about, in my single days, I had a roommate who had a dog, Josh, and Josh was terrible at passing gas.
Yeah.
He passed a lot of gas.
Yeah.
But you never would hear him. And I remember the two, Kurt and I, inviting a couple of gals over for dinner, and they're petting Josh, and suddenly the whole room is, you just about passed out. You need a gas mask. And both the women looked straight at us.
At you.
I said... It was Josh, and they said, oh, yeah, blame it on the dog.
Right, surely.
1-800-462-7413, our number to call. Coming up next, we'll find out what's in a name when it comes to finding that perfect name for your dog. And still to come later on in the show, a conversation with an author about the complex lives of the honeybees. Don't go away. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. You are listening to Calling All Pets.
Each week, Patricia and Larry give you great advice that helps you deal with your pet's behavior, but sometimes you want more. Do you want to go in depth into one of the pet topics you've heard on the show? Do you want more advice? More pet fun? Well, why not check out our website? It's callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we take some more calls, time for our week's topic. And Patricia, turns out there's more to naming a dog than simply pulling a name out of the hat, right? But why does it matter what we name our dogs?
Well, you know, it matters because of the impact that it has on you, the owner, on other people, and on your dog itself. For example... If you name your dog something that makes you happy just to say it, like I love to say Tulip. My Great Pyrenees name is Tulip.
And
just
a great name.
Saying Tulip, it just saying it makes me happy. And then I'm all happy when I'm communicating with her. And I think that might help make her happy too.
Yeah.
You know, it's a way to improve your relationship with your dog.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there's some names that can affect others around you by evoking particular emotions or expectations. Not always good ones.
All right. How so?
Well, say I have a big Rottie, you know, big Rottweiler.
Okay.
And I name it Killer or Brute. What are you going to think, you know, if I say, hey, Larry?
He's going to chew my leg off.
Well, yeah, you'd be a wee bit intimidated. Possibly, but Brute might be, as many Rottweilers are, the sweetest dog in the whole world. So be thoughtful about, you know, sometimes people sort of jokingly will name a dog something that sounds aggressive. But if it's a big dog, then you need to be thoughtful about that because you might end up biting yourself in the foot. On the other hand, if you look at it from another perspective, a dog's name can also affect the way we, the owners, treat it, and sometimes in a negative way. For example, and I've had several clients who did this, they named their dog Baby. And then they ended up with a 7-year-old adult male who was named really Baby, the equivalent of a 60-year-old man who was named Baby. And when we do that, you know, sometimes it changes the way we think of our dog, and it causes us to give them puppy privileges that they shouldn't necessarily get. So, you know, you might want to be thoughtful about that in sort of that perspective.
Okay, well, those are some of the ways dogs' names affect people, but how does a name affect the dog itself?
Well, good question, because it does. And as you know, Larry, I actually did some of my PhD research on this.
Yeah.
There's a lot of evidence that the dog's name has a direct effect on his or her behavior. The sound, just the structure of your dog's name, for example, has an influence on how your dog responds when you say his name.
So there are specific criteria to follow when it comes to naming a dog.
Yes, that relate to the sound itself. And what you choose depends on your objective. If you want, for example, a name that will grab your dog's attention, which most of us do,
if you think about it,
that's sort of why we use a name, right? Go for something relatively short and snappy and that has hard consonants on the end. You know, a perfect example is Kip. K and P. Kip.
Kip.
Right? And that gets a dog's attention better than a sound like Gwendolyn.
Aloysius.
Aloysius. And Kip is also a shorter name, which is really handy if you want to get your dog's attention in a hurry. You know, you want to call it to come away from the road. Kip, come. Now, if you have several dogs in your household, you also want to add on another criteria. Consider choosing names that can't be confused, that don't start with the same letter. I made this mistake, so don't do what I do. Do what I say. I named two dogs, Luke and Lassie.
And Lassie, yeah.
Both start with L. There were times where I could tell they both started to respond when I just got that first L out, and then they'd have to self-correct themselves. And, you know, it's hard enough for dogs to figure out what we want, so we don't want to confuse them anymore. But, you know, there are all these criteria I talked about, Larry, with acoustic structure and sound, but really I think the bottom line is pick a name that fits your dog's personality and that makes you happy. Because, you know, being happy, it's what it's all about, right?
Yeah. I'm happy. You're happy. You think we can find some happy listeners?
I think happy dogs, happy people. I would love to talk to some, you know, happy or unhappy listeners. We'll take them all.
We'll take them all. 1-800-462-7413. And here's a happy listener. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi.
Hi, we hope you're happy.
I am very happy to get through to you.
Oh, who are we speaking with?
My name is Jeannie from McCall, Idaho.
Jeannie, a pleasure to speak with you. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a 10-week-old yellow lab who is very happy. But,
oh, good.
We're having a horrible time crate training him, potty training him.
Oh.
I need help.
Oh, well, what's going on? Tell me what you are doing right now.
Right now, we are taking him out like every 2 hours after he eats, after he plays, and whenever we're outside, he goes with us. But at night, I put him in his crate, and he's good for maybe an hour or two. And then he starts barking, howling. And this morning, he messed in his crate.
Okay.
So I took it all out, cleaned it up, put him back in, and we ended up not sleeping in our crate last night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there are a couple of things that might be going on. There's lots you can do to make things better, and I think the chances are very, very good that things will get better pretty soon. One is to keep in mind he's only 10 weeks old, and that is really, really young. That's very, very young. So 2 hours between trips outside, way too long, way too long. When they're active, particularly in the morning hours and in the evening, I'll take puppies out every 15 minutes.
Oh, okay.
I mean, and what's most important is not only frequency, but that you go out with your puppy. You have some little food treats in your pocket. So when your puppy does go to the bathroom, you're not just going to say, good puppy. Because you know what? Your puppy's 10 weeks old, and what does that mean to him?
Yeah.
I mean, you might as well say, bleh, bleh, bleh. I mean, it's just noise. It doesn't mean anything. So I want you to say, good puppy, and then give him a treat right there. Don't let him trot back to you by the door. You go to him. So he doesn't get the treat for trotting back to you. He gets a treat for going to potty.
Okay.
Now, the crate issue is, you know, some dogs aren't comfortable in crates. And there's this misinterpretation of the fact that wolves have their babies in dens. And people always talk about dogs are den animals. Well, wolves go into dens to have their young. They don't live in dens otherwise. And dogs aren't wolves anyway. So, you know, the dogs don't read the chapter that says they're supposed to love being in little, small, denny areas. Now, a lot of dogs do like it, and a lot of dogs get very comfortable in crates, and they can be very handy. All my dogs love to go in their crates. But you still have to sort of ease many puppies into it. So, if he's barking an hour later, I would first of all make sure that you put him to bed sort of like you're supposed to put children to bed. Make sure he hasn't had lots and lots of exercise and stimulation right beforehand. You know, give him lots of exercise early in the evening and then sort of let him mellow out
a little bit.
Take him out last thing, give him a treat for going potty, and then put him in his crate. I would try using DAP, dog appeasing pheromone. It's just come out in a collar you can put on puppies now. Also as a spray, you can spray in the crate. There's a research project that just came out that showed that it decreased barking and stress-related kind of behaviors in a shelter setting.
Oh, great.
So I would definitely give that a try. And look at the crate. Make sure he's comfortable in it. He might be hot in it. If he can't get comfortable in a crate, you know, we used to raise puppies outside of crates. You could always just have a little area in the kitchen that's gated off. Maybe get a little X-Pen, little puppy set of gates. And restrict him that way. He might be lonely. You might want to put the crate in the bedroom. There are all kinds of things you might want to experiment with.
Mm-hmm.
And don't worry about the axe. I mean, I know it's not fun, but a 10-week-old puppy having an accident in the crate is not a crisis. He's very, very young.
Thank you very much for calling, Jean. Appreciate it, and good luck. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hi, you're at Calling All Pets.
Hello.
Hello, who are we speaking with?
This is Joel from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Joel, thank you for calling.
How are you today?
Well, we're doing just great. What can we do for you?
Well, we have two cats, and we rescued them from the Humane Society.
Well, good for you.
The older cat, Bray, they're both females. They're both fixed, obviously, because they're from the Humane Society. Bray is about 11 now. She's the older one. And up until now, they've both used their scratching post. But in the past year or so, Bray, if you leave leather shoes out, she scratches them. We've solved that problem. We make sure the shoes are away.
Okay.
The problem is now we can't leave the bathroom door open and the roll of toilet paper on paper roller.
Oh.
Because she will not only unroll it, but she'll completely shred it.
The favorite. I think cats think that we designed those as toys. I mean, you know, what else would it be, for heaven's sakes? You know, it's the perfect cat toy.
Yeah.
So
that's the dilemma right now. We're trying to figure out how to get her to, short of either closing the door or taking the roll completely off the roller and putting it up high where she can't get to
which
it.
Which is not particularly handy
way
to live, right? I certainly understand that. There are a couple of things you might want to try. One is booby trapping the toilet paper, basically. And you can do it in very friendly ways. You can spray citrus scent around it. A lot of cats don't like that smell, and there are lots of really nice sprays you can get that are real true oils of lemon or orange. Many cats don't like that spray, and they avoid it. Lots of cats don't like the smell of mothballs either, but then you know what? Neither do I.
Mm-hmm.
And mothballs can be toxic in some circumstances, so that might not be a great idea. Certainly the way you put, I mean, this is so trivial, but the way you put the toilet paper on, you know, we all know that. Does it come over from the front or does it go down the back? That can actually, I've had a couple clients who say, I just turned my toilet paper roll around and the cat stopped doing it.
See, we tried that, and I've always put it so it comes out from the bottom. That's just the way I do it.
Yeah.
And my wife will sometimes put it on the other way, but it doesn't seem to matter anymore. She's figured out how to get it unrolled
on both ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, so much for that easy idea. Well, so that's one idea. And the other thing to do is sort of ask yourself, why is she doing this? You know, is there something about the scratching post that either she doesn't like anymore or she doesn't have access to? Is the other cat stopping access? So one thing you might want to do is try also scratching posts in other places, other kinds of toys, add on some play. See, you know, try and look at it. So try and look at the big picture here. What's the big picture?
And we actually got a pet tip that relates to this, as a matter of fact. John from Crescent City, California, described how he fixed this problem with his two cats.
There we go. What
so,
timing?
Joel, get your pencil and paper handy here. Write these directions down. Take a 2-liter plastic soft drink bottle and cut the ends off to make a cylinder. Okay?
Okay.
Okay.
That's really attractive, but I can see it would work.
Cut the cylinder down to the length of the toilet paper roll.
Okay.
And then finally, cut open the long side of the bottle and slip it over the roll of toilet paper. It's easy to remove when you need the paper and easy to put back on when you're finished. And John says his cats clawed at the plastic that covered the toilet paper. They got no satisfaction after a while. They lost all interest in it. And, of course, after your cats are trained to leave the toilet paper alone, you can recycle your new invention with the rest of your plastic recyclables.
Well, that's a very practical idea.
Yeah, that does sound like a good idea.
I love one of the points he made, which is that eventually the cats just get out of the habit of it. So you don't have to have this out there for the rest of your bathroom's decor. You know, this could be a temporary change of habit. So that's a great idea. That's really good. Thanks, John.
And thanks to you, Joel.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate the call. And for pet tips, how do people give us a pet tip?
Oh, it's easy. Just send us an email and send it shockingly to pets@wpr.org.
Coming up next, we'll get the buzz on bees with author and beekeeper Holly Bishop. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. You are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Even man's best friend has a fault or two, so bring out the best in your pet with great advice from Tricia's dog training books. If you need help with a multi-dog household, or if you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, Tricia has a book that can help. Call the radio store at 800-747-7444. That's 800-747-7444, or visit our website at callingallpets.org.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week, we welcome Holly Bishop to the show. Holly is the author of Robbing the Bees, a biography of honey. It's now out in paperback. We're pleased to be able to talk with her. Holly, welcome to the program. Could you explain the title of your book?
Sure. It's called Robbing the Bees. It took me a while to figure out what I wanted to call this book. And then one day when I was with a beekeeper in Florida, who's sort of the character, the focus of my book, one morning as he was putting his veil on to go in and harvest some honey, to take, which is basically taking honey away from the bees, he said, let's rob some bees. And then I found out, I looked into that phrase a little bit and found out that a lot of beekeepers call honey harvesting robbing the bees.
Oh, that's interesting. And, you know, I really enjoyed hearing the story of this fellow that you worked with, and you also the fact that you wove sort of the history of bees as a species into your book. Could you talk a little about the history? Could you describe some of the history?
Sure. I'm a beekeeper myself, and so I had spent about I had been keeping bees for 5 years before I started writing the book, and I was just amazed at the depth of the history. I mean, bees have been on this planet since before humans. And then when humans came along, bees provided the only real source of sweetener on the planet. So bees have always been this highly sort of revered creature. And, of course, the honey was very sought after always.
How did they first come to America?
It is suspected that they came over even on the Mayflower. There's no actual record of it, but the next year a boat came over, and they did record having honeybees on board. So when the settlers came to the New World, I'm sure they couldn't imagine a New World without a sweetener. So they brought the source. They brought hives on the Mayflower and boats that came after.
I'm sure none of my ancestors ever made it over on the Mayflower, but it's interesting to know that every ancestor of every bee made it.
It's amazing.
That's right. And besides providing sweeteners for us through history, your book mentions that they were used actually as military weapons. Is that right?
There's a chapter. I learned so much in researching and writing this book, and there I wouldn't have thought that I would include so much information on bees used in warfare, but there really is a long history.
That's amazing.
Because you could collect bees in a gourd or a clay vessel or something and throw it down a hillside, over the ramparts at your enemies, and by the time the bees had gone sailing through the air and hit your enemies, they were mad enough to sting. Because bees really only sting if they're provoked, and that was enough provocation. There are lots of examples of bees being put into the tunnels of enemy warriors as they were tunneling towards your village, and if you found the tunnel, you could just fill it with bees and chase them out.
That's amazing. In contrast to thinking of the aggressive side of bees, I was lucky enough to be involved in a research educational project in which we very carefully painted tiny little dots of color on the thoraxes of bees and then followed them as individuals when they danced in the hive. And I became so fond of some individuals that the day that white dot, green dot didn't come back was sad day. And I'm just wondering how... If you've made connections with individuals, or how you feel about the bees yourself personally?
That's such a good question. I don't think I've had as intimate an individual bond as you got with, what was it, white and green dot?
White dot, green dot, right.
But I have two hives now, and each one of them has about 60,000 bees in the middle of summer, so it would be hard to get to know all of them. But as an organism, I do feel a real connection to just sitting next to the hive and watching the bees come and go and knowing what they're doing. And this year, for example, I have one hive. They're right next to each other, my two hives, and one of them is producing and sort of thriving at double the rate of the other one. And so it's like having a sort of not a pet, but a creature, a guest who's not well. And I'm really relating to that sort of poor, sick hive right now and trying to figure out how to fix it.
Oh. You've you can make mistakes in something like that and create problems, or you can make it better. And I know you've made some mistakes. You talk about them in your book.
Had to bring it up.
But I laughed pretty hard at that. Well, tell us about the worst mistake.
Oh, it's beekeeping is, and that's what I learned in, the last 8 years. It's a pretty constant and steep learning curve, but there's one anecdote I tell in the book where I think it was my second year of beekeeping, and I was feeling very cocky and, like I knew everything about beekeeping. And I had just gotten out of a shower and remembered something that I hadn't done in the hives before I had taken my shower, and went out all sort of clean and smelling all good, and decided I would just fix whatever the problem was in the hive, and reached into the hive with my hair flowing and down and wet, and a bunch of bees came out to see what was going on, because that was a pretty major intrusion into the hive, and these poor bees got stuck in my hair because it was hanging down into the hive. And so, that was just dumb on my part, and I sort of had to stand there really still, hoping the bees would be able to get out of my hair. But because they have a little bit of honey on each of their 6 feet and legs, they got all tangled up in my hair. And we all panicked, me and the bees, and I ended up sort of crushing them. This is really embarrassing to say, but I crushed them into my head, hoping that I would kill them before they stung me, but I didn't. They each got me before I killed them.
Well, I think your love of bees and your humility speaks speaks very well of you to be worried about the bees as well as yourself.
Oh, well, it wasn't their fault. I mean, you really do feel that way. They're so generous. Everything they do is to make honey and, you know, pollinate plants, and it feels bad every time you sort of waste a life by mistake like that.
Sure.
And they're so busy making that honey in spring and summertime, and I think most people see them out and about. And one of the things you talk about in your book, which is the evolution, as it were, from using honey as a sweetener to processed sugars and other sweeteners, mm-hmm. sometimes to the disadvantage of bees and beekeepers. Would you give our listeners some reasons or a reason to consider honey instead of sugar?
Well, I can think of so many, and unfortunately, they involve sugar bashing. You know, I think that artificial sweeteners are evil, to say the least, and also I would be concerned because there's so much that still isn't even known about them. I mean, the things like Splenda, that is now, it's an artificial sweetener being put into all kinds of soft drinks and foods, and mm-hmm. they don't even know what it does in 5 years. So I think one reason to use honey is because you don't know what a lot of those artificial sweeteners are.
And we've certainly had a lot of experience with honey. It's not,
it's not like
we haven't had
millennia. There's really not a big downside to honey.
And you're the person you wrote about in your book, the guy,
Smiley.
Donald Smiley, if you can believe that name.
Donald Smiley, and he was really into Tupelo honey, which is, I guess, the sort of the gold standard is...
It's a gold standard for a couple of reasons. Probably the first being that it only grows in, you know, this area of the Florida Panhandle, basically this swampland of Florida. And so there's this real cachet to it. It's like, you know, a wine that only comes from one vineyard.
Right.
And it also, it has a very nice, mild, buttery flavor and doesn't crystallize very easily, which is what a lot of people really like about Tupelo.
Well, you're making us both hungry. We're going to run
drooling.
Right off and eat some honey.
Sounds good.
Holly, thank you so much.
Thank you both.
Holly Bishop is the author of Robbing the Bees, a biography of honey. She spoke to us from her home in New York. Maybe you'd like to speak to us as well, and if so, give us a call now at 1-800-462-7413. And we have some callers online. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Kelly from Davenport, Iowa.
Hi, Kelly. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I was calling. I just have this interesting thing. My cat is highly attracted to harmonica sounds.
And no kidding.
We discovered it one day out of the blue. They were cleaning out my grandma's house and pulled out a harmonica and started playing it. And she came running from across the house and crying and excited and getting your face. And,
no kidding.
She does it. She can do it even if she sees it. She starts to get excited and was researching online and found that everything said that was like the worst sound for cats. And so I was just curious as to if this is normal or what is causing this attraction to the harmonica.
Maybe it could be the kind of harmonica, because some harmonicas, the tones would be a little different, and they may have a sound, your harmonica may have a sound close to the tone of a bird, for example.
That's a very interesting comment and far beyond anything I would be able to say, because I was like, my brain was going research on cats and harmonicas, researching and finding absolutely nothing. But Larry makes a really good point, is that, you know, there are some sounds that with minor changes, for example, sounds that gets dogs howling, it's hard to say, can get dogs howling in seemingly sort of a happy, excited way, or also can cause them to behave as though they're distressed. And either way, it gets their attention.
Sure.
We're not really sure what's going on. So I like the bird possibility very, very well. And also remember, there's a kind of a chirping sound that female cats give sometimes. And there's also kind of a chatter that all cats or many cats give when they see birds but can't get at them. That sort of like that.
Yeah.
The little chatter kind of sound.
Yeah.
I obviously can't do it very well. But it's possible that that's replicating one of those kind of sounds. I think you should follow up on Larry's idea and get other harmonicas and have a little harmonica orchestra and see if you get a different response to different harmonicas. Maybe you could turn this into a cat toy that makes you millions of dollars.
There
Who knows? We'll have you on as a guest next.
Thanks. It could be even hormonal, I suppose. Maybe they're mistaking the cat for another cat.
That's what we wondered, because she just purrs and it just gets so excited. We don't, you know, just... She gets right up there, and she'll lay down in your lap and just purr and puts her face right. It gets her ear right up to it, and so we didn't know if it was like a traction thing as another cat or something.
It's. I think research is necessary.
Okay.
Thanks, Kelly.
Push it. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Don't go away. We'll be taking some more calls in just a minute. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. You are listening to Calling All Pets.
Do you have a question for Patricia? I know. Just call the 1-800 number, right? But you're shy, and the idea of talking on the radio gives you hives. So how do you get your question on Calling All Pets? We have a solution. It's called email. Send your pet behavior questions to pets@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. Want to join in? It's easy. Give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And somebody did just that. Let's go to our phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Nancy.
Nancy, where were you calling from?
I'm calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak with you. And what can we do for you?
I have a 2.5-year-old Mastiff named Zeke, who is the biggest mama's boy on the planet. And he is usually with me all the time, but occasionally I have to travel for business and he can't go. And he will not go outside for anybody else. He cries and moans and acts like he's completely lost.
Oh,
boy.
And you can't put him in your overhead suitcase?
No, at 212 pounds, I can't just put a handle on his back and pretend he's my briefcase.
Be a little tricky, huh? Well, I really sympathize. It sounds like he's almost, you know, some dogs almost get addicted. We use codependency with other people.
My housemate has tried everything to get him out when I'm not there, including a peanut butter sandwich, raw meat, cheese, and his dog is full and pretty much doesn't want dinner after that.
Right.
And my dog won't move off the floor.
And how much does your housemate interact with this dog when you are home?
Quite a bit.
And he'll go outside if your housemate takes the dog out?
No, pretty much only if I will. We've tried to do this together, and if I don't go outside, the dog won't go outside.
Wow, he really is addicted to you.
Yeah.
One thing I would do is I would find a certified applied animal behaviorist, if you could, in your area. Find somebody who's used to working with sort of addictions and phobias, sort of beyond a general dog training kind of paradigm. So if you could get a coach to come in and do a house call, that would be a great idea if you have somebody in your area. You might want to go to the Animal Behavior Society has a website of applied animal behaviors, and the American Veterinary Society also has some certified applied animal behaviors. So that's one thing to think about, if that would work. What I would try in the meantime, what I would try is, first of all, figure out what Zeke loves more than anything in the world besides you. Obviously, you're the main thing. But find his favorite food or his favorite toy or whatever it is and condition it to a cue. So you're basically going to condition him to feel extra good when you say this. Let's just make it up. Say he has a toy he loves more than anything in the world. Let's say it's a piece of steak. When you're there and you give him steak, he's really, really happy. So use a cue for that. Use a specific cue. Oh boy, did you want your steak? And then give him a piece of steak. And the reason I say that is because the beauty of classical conditioning is that you can pair two things and they will both eventually evoke the same emotional response. So eventually you can say, oh boy, do you want your steak? And he can be as happy when he hears that as he is when he actually eats steak. So try doing a number of those kind of exercises, and then you're going to have your housemate do more and more of them. One thing you might want to do is absolutely first thing in the morning when we know all mammals need to urinate, you know, right? Dogs just
yes.
as well as us.
Take advantage of the situation.
Is you and your housemate take the dog outside in the backyard together, but then before he's urinated, you're going to go inside. But he's still really going to have to pee. So he pees, your housemate gives him a piece of steak. You come out right after that and say, good boy, good boy. And then you gradually start expanding the time between when he gets a piece of steak and when you come outside.
That's a great idea.
So you see, basically use that kind of scenario in all kinds of different contexts and settings to try and sort of ease that kind of transition.
And thanks very much for calling, Nancy. Good luck to you.
Yeah, good luck.
You know, Tricia, we heard from a listener named Heather, and boy, does she have a peculiar problem.
Larry's laughing
this is
already.
One you may have not have heard before. She says, I taught my two cats to use the toilet. I've been great to lead a litter-free life, but now they actually dig in the toilet.
Oh, no.
Nah, I've tried everything to get them to stop, even putting foil on the inside of the toilet bowl, but nothing works. Please help. This is a very gross, very embarrassing problem. I'm not willing to go back to litter because I'm convinced there is a solution. Tricia, what is that solution?
Well, I'm going to turn this over to our listeners because I don't know what it is. If you want to send us your ideas, do send us an email to pets@wpr.org. And you think I'm really just sort of getting out of this one. But the truth of the matter is, and you're not, I'm saying this apologetically because I don't think you're going to like this answer. The truth of the matter is I have heard of case after case after case of people who tried or successfully trained their cats to use a toilet and then were sorry. Now, you're not sorry about part of it because you don't like the litter. However, here's what has often happened with these toilet training kits that are on the market. And some of them are very successful. I should be really clear. Some people do this, and they're really, really happy with it. I don't hear from them.
No.
So I hear a selected sort of biased sample of the problems. But the problems I hear are, one, either the cats never get it, but then they stop going in their litter box, and now you have a cat who goes on the carpet or the bed. Second, cats who, and this is a very common problem, jump up on the toilet and then go potty on the seat. Mm-hmm. And people tend not to like that. You, yeah. I have to admit, you're the first one who's come up with the problem of the cats digging. But here's the reason I don't know what to tell you is because the action of digging after urinating is not learned. It's innate. It's an innate behavior that is hardwired in your cat, and it's extremely hard to get rid of. The only wild idea I could come up with is give your cat something right around that area. Maybe a little addition that's on the outside of the rim of the toilet of something the cat could dig in, maybe not litter, since that would be sort of the worst of all possible, have litter and a dirty toilet. but maybe some kind of substance that gave the cat a feeling it could dig in something. Maybe sometimes little soft plush things cats will dig in. Sometimes peanuts, although those might clog your toilet if they get in, so you need to be careful. But I know you don't like this, but the fact of the matter is that switching cats off litter onto toilets works for some people, but not for others. And delinking, scratching, and urinating or defecating is a great challenge. But maybe somebody out there has had this problem and will email us.
And again, the email is
pets@wpr.org.
And here's the number to call if you have a question, 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, this is Ken from West Palm Beach.
West Palm Beach, Florida. Ken, thanks for calling. How can we help?
Well, I have a Newfoundland, and I trained him myself because I knew he'd be a handful if I didn't get him lined out pretty good. And the only problem I have with him, of course, they're a natural retriever. When we go to the ocean and we toss his stick in the ocean, he won't give it back.
Oh, I don't want to give up my stick. But he'll probably come right up to you and show it to you, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then
he'll want me to play with him in tug-of-war, but he won't give it up.
Gotcha. Now, have you tried the usual two-stick routine?
Yep, and I can usually do, it depends on if he's figured me out or not that day. Sometimes he'll go, ha-ha, no way I'm going to do this.
You know, one thing that works really well is to actually start almost from zero. And do it outside of the context where you'd normally play your fetch games. Maybe you're in your backyard, pick up a stick, hand it to him, and say, take it. I like to put both of these things on cue. Take it and drop or leave it would be to give it back to me. So show him the stick as he starts to move his mouth towards it. Say, take it. Drop it. Don't keep your hand on it, because as soon as you have your hand on it, then you're playing tug of war, which dogs just love. Yeah. And it's not going to help you get that stick out of his mouth. But you're going to have a tasty, and I mean a tasty treat, and not tasty to us, tasty to dogs, a really great tasty treat in your other hand.
Right.
And you're going to say, drop, and then you're going to move the treat right to his nose and let him smell it. And almost all dogs, not all, but 99.99% of them will open their mouth to take the treat. And you say, good boy. And then you pick up the stick and you give it back to him. Take it. So what he starts learning is, if I open my mouth, something wonderful happens. And you can slowly evolve that into having a treat in your hand, saying drop, and he drops it. And then you don't give him the treat. You just pick up the stick and you throw it again. And what he starts learning is dropping the stick leads to something fun, whether it's another chase game or it's a treat in his mouth. And I'll tell you, when I got one of my dogs, Lassie, she was a year old, she was the worst hoarder of a ball or a stick. She would come up to you with it, she would turn her head away, she would tuck her head under her chest.
Yeah, she does all that.
She grew up with little kids who were always reaching for the ball, and I sort of didn't pay attention to it for quite a while because it just wasn't an issue with me. But in 3 days... using this food, I taught her to drop on cue. So,
great.
And Noofs are usually pretty smart guys, so give that a try.
Give it a shot. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Patricia, thank you. It was a lot of fun again.
It's always fun. My pleasure.
Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Don't forget, if you have a pet tip you'd like to share, send it to us. Here's how you do it. You just email us at pets@wpr.org. Calling All Pets is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0224P and bring out the best in your pet with great advice from Tricia's dog training books. Whether you need help with training a new puppy or if you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, Tricia has a book that can help. Call the radio store at 800-747-7444 or visit our website at callingallpets.org.